Introduce yourself, please.
I'm State Senator David Pierce from Warrensburg. I represent the 21st Senatorial District, and that's eight counties in West Central Missouri: Johnson County, where I'm from, Lafayette County, Ray, Caldwell, Livingston, Saline, Carroll, and Howard counties.
He got them all. Let's get started.
This is State House Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. And welcome to the production studio here at KCUR 89.3. I am Brian Ellison, and it is good to have Senator David Pierce, Republican from Warrensburg, with us. He is not alone. We're also joined here in the studio today by Pat Kelly, who is a Kansas City Public Schools teacher. Welcome to you, Pat.
Thank you. Good morning.
And joined from across the state by Skype by St. Louis Public Radio's Jason Rosenbaum. Jason, good to have you back on the program.
It's great to be back here.
I am sorry that you're not able to reach those delicious-looking donuts that are sitting in front of Pat right now.
That's okay. I have my vitamin water and my red, white, and blue headband on, and that's all I need.
That's frankly, that's too much information, but thanks anyway, Jason. We always like to get started by getting to know our legislator guest. And David, if you wouldn't mind telling us a little about your family and your pets.
Family and pets. Married to Teresa,
uh-huh.
And she's a teacher, and she does vision therapy as well.
Okay.
And have two children. One is Molly. She lives in Decatur, Illinois. But I think she and her husband are moving to Kansas City later this summer.
Couldn't stand to be away, huh?
Well, they've been there for quite a while.
Okay.
And so her husband Andy's taken a position with UMKC. So we're excited for them to be moving back to this area.
Excellent.
Have a son named Andrew. And the pets, we're down to one pet now,
a cat
named Stella.
Stella. How long have you had Stella?
Probably 5 or 6 years.
All right.
And Andrew brought Stella home from the grocery store. Stella was on death's door.
Mm-hmm.
And so we kept Stella in the garage for a couple of weeks. And I said, that's great, but it will never come in the house. And then I was gone for a weekend, and I came in, and Stella was in the house. And so
and she hasn't left since.
She has not left. So great, great cat. At times we have chickens, and so we hope to get back in the chicken business again this spring.
You have the chickens for the eggs? Is that the
yeah.
purpose?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Occasionally, if we have kind of a crazy rooster, we have it for food.
Really good soup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I once had chickens, and that was not going to be an option, was made clear in my household.
So, is that right?
Yeah,
okay.
No, they were only for eggs. So tell us a little bit about how you got hooked on politics in the first place.
Politics has always fascinated me. I remember in third grade,
mm-hmm.
I was elected as chairman of the Richard Nixon campaign.
Wow, I didn't realize the campaign was reaching down quite
so far into
the elementary school.
Yeah, so I remember that, and my best friend, he ran against me. He lost, so he was the campaign manager for George Wallace. So so it's just always fascinated me. And you know, some kids traded baseball cards or did other things. I collected presidential memorabilia. And so it's just I've just been hooked ever since.
So you represent the senatorial district that includes Warrensburg, includes eight counties you mentioned. Tell us a little bit about the district and maybe what's going on there these days. What are the hot issues in your senatorial district?
Well, it's a very diverse district. In fact, our citizen who's on here today, Pat.
Yes.
He's the citizen. I'm not. Is that how that
right.
works?
Right. He's the real person. You're the
okay.
senator.
Okay. And Pat has relations or yeah. relatives in
family in Higginsville,
yeah.
in Lafayette County.
Mm-hmm.
And my daughter went to first 2 years, played volleyball for Cotty College in Nevada, which
oh,
is
no
also
kidding.
In your district, I think. So very familiar. But it is diverse, isn't it?
Quite, oh, it is.
Quite a lot of differences there.
It is. And you know, it's rural. And so a lot of the things that I look is through the prism of rural Missouri, whether that's education or health care or jobs, economic development. Warrensburg is the biggest town in that entire district. That's about 18,000 people. And so there aren't any large cities in there. It's pretty rural.
Mm-hmm.
And so agriculture, small business, higher education with University of Central Missouri, but yet have several other colleges, Wentworth
mm-hmm.
Military Academy in Lexington, Missouri Valley in Marshall, and then Central Methodist in Fayette. So have four colleges. And then, of course, Whiteman Air Force Base is unique to the world. And to have that in there, thrown in the mix, just makes it a really interesting, dynamic district to represent.
Yeah, sounds like a really interesting place. We have a lot to talk about today. We have campaign finance. We have ethics reform being discussed this week in the legislature. We have lots of education issues. I want to start by going around the table, as we always do, including the virtual table that extends all the way to St. Louis. We'll start with Jason Rosenbaum. Jason, what's on your mind this week?
Well, I was in Jefferson City last week filling in for St. Louis Public Radio's Marshall Griffin, and it was a very eventful week, not only on the issues, but kind of side issues that caught a lot of people's attention. As a lot of people know by now, a state representative from Baldwin, Don Gosin, resigned due to then unspecified personal reasons, but it later came out at the Post-Dispatch that he resigned due to the circumstances surrounding an affair. And at the same time, the Senate was debating one of the first House ethics bills that came to the Senate, a one-year cooling off period for most lawmakers to become lobbyists. And I want to ask the senator a couple of questions. Number one, even though it's in the House and not the Senate, although a senator did resign recently under certainly unsavory circumstances, what do you think a resignation like this brings to the image of the General Assembly, and how do you think it affects the ongoing discussion about ethics, given that many of the ethics bills, as Senator Bob Dixon of Springfield pointed out, don't really have a lot to do with what caused John Deal or Don Gosin or Paul Lavoda to resign in the first place?
Well, it's just terrible. Anytime that you hear something like this happening, none of us take any glee in this. It's just a terrible thing to happen to the institution. And, of course, it just, I think, further erodes the confidence that people have in elected officials. Now, there's 197 of us, and so you've just mentioned three or four incidences. And so there's not that many, but still, that's now the perception. And so it's just awful. At the end of the day, I am only responsible for myself and my actions. And I can't dictate, or I can't ask or tell people how to conduct themselves. They will do what they'll do. And so at the end of the day, I mean, they're responsible for their actions. I am for mine. But it still casts a shadow on the whole state capitol.
Yeah, I mean, to Jason's point, the ethics reform legislation that's been debated this time or been debated in the past, not really much that it can do about members of the General Assembly having affairs, right?
Oh, the timing was awful. It could not have been worse, because the House was trying to take a proactive step to kind of clean things up. The House member resigns on the day that the Senate was talking about an ethics bill. And, you can't write a script like this. But yet it all boils down to electing people with character. And no matter what laws or rules you put in, if a person doesn't have character, if they don't personally have a moral compass, it doesn't matter what kind of legislation you write.
Fair enough. Let's continue around the table. Pat
Kelly, can I build on that just for a second,
please.
Senator? Do you support the cooling off period piece of between out of the legislature before you start lobbying? Is that something you would personally support?
I did not vote for the version that we had on Thursday. To me, I don't really support a cooling off period. We have term limits in the state. And so as an elected official, we're already told how long we can serve. And so then once we're out of office, I don't necessarily think it's the state's business what you do when you're no longer an elected official. I do think probably on the federal level where certain congressmen, congresswomen can actually steer billions of dollars worth of projects, I think that's probably more important. What we did do in the Senate was say you can't leave early to become a lobbyist. So you need to fulfill that commitment to the voters. But then once you're done with that commitment, then you should be able to go into any line of service.
Okay. Could I talk a couple of education bills?
Sure.
If I can, I jump right in.
By all means.
You wrote a transfer bill this year.
Right.
How's that going?
Tell us what a transfer bill is.
A transfer allows for transfers from failing school districts into adjacent, I believe,
right.
School districts or charter schools, et cetera. It gives more. The idea is that the parent wouldn't be able to take the child out of the failing district.
And not only adjacent districts, but adjacent counties. Mm-hmm. So in the case of Kansas City, if it was unaccredited, mm-hmm. they could go to Lee Summit, but they could also go to Higginsville, because Higginsville is in an adjoining county.
Mm-hmm. So, or Clay County, right?
Oh, exactly, right, mm-hmm. right.
Yeah, so, and Pat is asking, what do you think of that kind of legislation?
Well, there are some districts that need some help that are either unaccredited or provisionally accredited. And the last couple of years, we've tried to do that. And 2 years in a row, the governor's vetoed that. I guess my overall thought, and I chair the Senate Education Committee, is to not fundamentally change public schools around the state just to accommodate a few districts. However, for those districts that need help, we need to give them the tools to do that. And so I think that students in unaccredited districts should have the ability to transfer out, but let's make sure that that number is as small as possible. And so one of the things I've done in a transfer bill this year is to try to have accreditation not done on district-wide basis, but accredit individual buildings. And so if you have an unaccredited building, then the students can leave. But if you have an accredited building, that means things are working. Mm. Teachers, administration, parental support is working. So then if that's the case, then you wouldn't have that ability to transfer out.
Okay.
Pat, you are a member of the Kansas City Federation of Teachers. You're, in fact, your building representative for the local AFT mm-hmm. chapter. What do you think of transfer bills?
Well, I think it's something that the devil's in the details, as always.
Right.
Kids and parents, I think, should have the ability to get the best education possible. I think the fact that some of these transfer bills actually make the situation in the district that the kid is transferring out of make it worse for the other kids in that district.
By taking the funding away.
Well, yeah, taking the funding away. And how do you get them to the school, the transportation issues? So there's a lot of things that I think need to be worked out. And maybe the focus would be on how do we get them accredited more than how do we get the kids out of there after things are so bad. I think that's where I would say, how are we looking at that?
Yeah, well, Pat, you're exactly right. I mean, if you take more and more students out of that existing district and they get less funding, less quality teachers, it's like a death spiral. Mm-hmm. And that's not good for anybody. So mm-hmm. so I definitely agree with that.
And of course, the money to move these students from, say, Northeast Middle School on Independence Avenue down 24 Highway to Lexington or wherever we might put them, that gets to be an additional expense that we don't have a whole lot of money anywhere in the education department, I think, for those additional expenses. Since we brought up the union question, I have to ask you about 1891. Which is the Paycheck Deception Act.
Paycheck Protection?
Protection. Okay. I've seen it presented both ways. What are we trying to protect? Because clearly, I think it's no surprise to you that AFT and other unions see that really as kind of a direct attack on our ability to raise and continue to keep resources to support union members.
And we need to clarify for listeners, and we may have to give you both a chance to define what the bill does.
Equal time here.
The Paycheck Deception Act, as you put it, the Paycheck Protection Act, as it is actually titled.
So you can probably tell which direction I'm leaning.
We're both sides of this coin.
Senator Pierce, tell us what the bill proposes to do.
This has been brought up several times over the past few years, and it's passed in, I believe, both chambers at one time or another. It just passed in the House this week.
Veto-proof.
Right. Veto-proof, meaning it has a supermajority, so if the governor vetoes it, which more than likely he will, then they would have the two-thirds votes to override it in the House. Primarily, what in my opinion, is what it does is it says that if you're in a union, then you need to, once a year on an annual basis, give authority for dues to be taken out of your paycheck. And for those of us who are in support of that, and I am in support of it, I think, you know, what does a union have to fear? If they're offering a good service, if they're providing something for their members, then why should you have to worry about taking that out of the dues every year? And so, to me, it is protecting that person's paycheck, so it's just not an automatic deduct.
Obviously, you disagree, Pat?
Well, one of the things we saw in Michigan and in Wisconsin, where these bills have been in effect, is it really had a negative effect because the districts, the infrastructure that have been deducting these dues out of our checks, and it's just a payroll administrative process from what I understand, that gets left out and we can't do that anymore. So we've had a big movement to try and get people to do this independently like that. How long would we have if the bill is passed before the districts could no longer, how long of a transitional period would we be able to have? Would you expect that to go very quickly, or would there be 90 days or somewhere where we could make that transition from automatic deducting from the district we work for into a more modern, I think they call it easy pay here, where they deduct it straight from our checking account?
That's a good question. I do know that most bills go into effect on August 28th of the year that's enacted. I have not actually seen the House bill language to know when that would be, and we have not brought it up on the Senate floor, so I don't know how long. But that's a good question. How long would you have? Would it be on August 29th, or would you have an implementation period? I don't know, but that would be a good thing that we need to discuss once on the floor.
Is it going to come this week? Do you know?
There was
some talk about that might come up this week. But
there's a possibility. You know, we did talk about ethics this past week, and there are six different ethics bills. We only got through one. So from my understanding, we're probably going to go back to we're gonna get some ethics next week.
some will be very ethics. Pleased right. to hear that that's finally happening.
Finally, right?
So, but let's actually talk about that. These various ethics bills, they're getting hearings. There was an initial big push on the House side that actually several of the provisions that have been talked about for years were approved by that body. Others were sort of stripped out of consideration, have not been approved. Where do you see ethics reform going this session? Will we finally see ethics reform in the Missouri General Assembly?
Well, everyone has a different definition of ethics reform. To me, if we don't put campaign contribution limits on, we're not really having true ethics reform.
Right. It's sort of a subset of this broader ethics question. I know you have introduced a bill specifically dealing with campaign campaign contributions.
Senate Bill 570. I mean, right now it's just window dressing is what we're doing. We're not getting to the heart of the matter. We're more concerned right now in our discussion about if a lobbyist can buy me a cheeseburger, but we don't care if the same lobbyist gives $1 million check to my campaign.
Which currently they're perfectly legally allowed to do.
Absolutely. And we've seen checks for $250,000, $500,000, $750,000, and even $1 million check to campaigns. And this has been going on since 2008, and at the time that we passed it, it was somewhat an experiment, and the experiment is not working.
You're one of just a handful of Republican legislators who has been calling for some sort of campaign contribution limits. The Senate bill that you proposed would make a $1,250 limit for representative races, $2,500 limit on any gift to a senatorial race, and $5,000 for the statewide offices. I've heard other senators proposing somewhat different numbers,
right,
but similar in the same range. But each of them has sat, some of them in that very chair where you're sitting, and said they're going to give it a shot, but they don't know that it has a very good chance of passing.
Well, again, I think if we're going to have true ethics reforms, we have to have limits on campaign contributions. Most states have that. We have limits on the federal level. And I just think these large campaign donations pollute the system. In my last election, 2012, in the primary, my opponent, I got $200,000 from one source in one check, and that really affects elections. Mm-hmm. And when I started in 2002, we had limits, and we lived within those. And another thing it does is I think overall the donors give the same amount of money, but it's targeted in different ways. Now they give it to leadership, or they just give it to the folks that they think really have a good chance in growing in their parties. And so a lot of the folks just starting out, they get no donations. And so it's really affected also not maybe the amount, but where those donations are targeted.
So we've had Republican leaders in the Senate, or actually in the House, tell us that the problem with an approach like the one you're recommending is that it only results in the same people making the same big donations, but those being broken up into smaller donations assigned to other people's names. Basically, the same money gets into the system, but it's harder to track. It's less transparent. How would you respond to that criticism of this kind of legislation?
Well, that was the argument in 2006 and 2008. Just take off all the limits and just have open transparency. And so it is transparent. I mean, you know exactly who gave the money when it goes directly from individuals or corporations. But I think it's transparent, but I still think it pollutes the system. I think it creates disadvantages for those that are trying to get involved in politics. I think it unfairly gives influence to certain rich donors that are out there. And so I think no matter what system we have, people are going to try to get around it, and they will find loopholes. But that still doesn't mean that we can't improve the system. I mean, it's against the law to murder. It's against the law for armed robbery, and people still break those laws. Does that mean we shouldn't have the laws to begin with?
Do you think that's a valid criticism, though? I mean, do you think that will happen, that a lot of small donations will just come in place of the big the big gift, or is there some way that that can be prevented?
Well, I think it's a step in the right direction. I don't think we'll ever have a perfect system, but I think we have to try.
Could I ask
you
a layman's
question? Do you mind if I chime in here for a second?
Yeah, Jason, go ahead.
Well, I have seen Missouri under campaign finance limits, I guess, after the 2006 law was thrown out. And I think that, in theory, capping campaign contribution limits seems like a reasonable option. But the reality that happened in Missouri, both before that and before limits were taken off, is that big donations were put into like legislative district committees and third-party PACs, and they were diffused so much that it was impossible to track a lot of big donations that were going to a lot of people. And you see on a federal level that there are campaign contribution limits, but a big donor could give the max to a candidate and then turn around and give $1 million or $2 million to a super PAC that's supporting that same candidate. So if your bill ends up passing either as is or through an initiative petition, how can you guarantee that a similar situation on the federal level or what was going on in Missouri before limits were taken off isn't going to happen again?
Well, I can't have any authority over the federal level, but in my bill, Senate Bill 570, we have said that donations to 501c4s, any donation to that 501c4, which is an educational corporation, the identity of those donors must be revealed. And so right now, you're right, Jason, you can somewhat hide your identity through that. So if you have to reveal your identity as an individual, then you should also reveal that when you donate to 501c4s.
Pat, you were trying to jump in there a moment ago.
I have a real basic question. How much does it cost to run for the state Senate? When we hear $1 million check and $200,000 check, how much money is really in there? I'm sure I have no idea.
That's a great question.
I'm really surprised to hear these figures.
How much did you spend last campaign?
When my primary was, I spent about $500,000 instead of my opponent. So that was $1 million. The general election wasn't quite as contested. That was another $100,000. So for me to get elected was $600,000.
That's a lot of money.
Is that unusual?
It totally depends how contested it is. Also, if you're in a TV market, we're going to have a very contested state Senate race in Boone County. A lot of intensity will be there. I would predict that both candidates will spend $2 million apiece.
Wow.
And you know what the salary is for a state Senate?
I don't know.
$35,000.
$35,000, $2 million campaign.
Yeah.
What a bargain.
Plus term limits, right?
Yeah, so plus term limits. That's right.
I do want to go back to the ethics debate that happened this week a little bit. I was in the Senate chamber when the Senate had a vote on whether to place, I guess, a 1.5-year cooling off period. It's complicated. There were like a lot of amendments. I don't really want to explain it because it makes my head hurt at this point. But the fact of the matter is, when there was a standing division on putting a 1.5-year cooling off period, pretty much every senator except for 5 basically voted against it. And you mentioned your particular reason why you're against it from a philosophical standpoint. But why do you think so many of your colleagues are so resistant to the idea of a cooling off period between when legislators can lobby? Because from the outside looking in, I'm not making this accusation, but I have heard others say this. It may be because some of them may want to lobby themselves after their term ends.
Yeah, I've already expressed my thought that, you know, we're already limited to how long we can serve. And so how much right do you have to tell a person what they can do when they leave the chamber? And so I would think those that voted against that probably felt the same way. And quite honestly, a lot of us that are in the legislature aren't exactly sure what our next step is going to be. And so they want to be sure that when they vote, they're not taking options away from themselves or perceived as a conflict of interest, that they're doing something to feather their nest when they leave. You know, I was very careful how I voted and what I said because I'm leaving very soon. And so I wanted to be very sure that it wasn't perceived as a conflict of interest. And yet I have definite opinions. So I stated that and I voted that way in the debate.
Would you consider being a lobbyist after leaving the Senate?
Well, like I said, I'm not sure what my future plans are. As far as a lobbyist is concerned, probably not one of those contract lobbyists that have 40 or 50 clients. But there are some organizations over the years that I've worked for, that I have a lot of respect for, that we have the same common goals. And if an opportunity came forward, I wouldn't put that out of the range of possibility. So I don't know at this point.
Want to tell us?
Yeah,
which
just to kind of again chime in a little bit.
Maybe.
Well, actually, Jason, let me not let him off the ropes quite yet. What Sorry. Organization are you thinking about?
Public radio.
Oh well, then we support that 100%. Jason, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, I could kind of see where you're coming from there, because I think one of the things that I heard that this could potentially bar is if you get termed out of office and want to become like the head of. And I'm throwing out a random example, like the Missouri Cattlemen's Association or the Farm Bureau or some advocacy group that has a lot of members but would probably require you to register as a lobbyist if you became a head of that organization.
Right.
So I guess I can understand, like, there's hesitancy under that particular scenario. But, you know, there have been occasions when lawmakers have become lobbyists after their term ends. As I think your colleague, Senator Dave Schatz, pointed out, I don't think it's a huge amount. I think it's like 4% of all the registered lobbyists right now. But it was very noticeable to me that many of your colleagues had philosophical objections to that particular bill. So,
yeah, and what Senator Schatz did is he counted all of the registered lobbyists, like 970 or so, and then he counted how many are former state reps and senators, and it was just about 4%. So it's not that large of a number, but I think the perception is, you know, that there needs to be some kind of limits or some kind of rules. And what the Senate strongly said is you should not leave early. You should not quit your term early to become a lobbyist.
I want to switch gears a little bit. You're the chair of the Senate Education Committee. We had one education question already, but something that's been very much in the news the last couple of months is the situation at the University of Missouri. Protests on campus, concern about issues of race on campus, a change in the presidency of the system. How do you think that situation is unfolding? Are you pleased with the direction that the university is going at this point?
It is probably the one issue that's dominating everything else in the legislature. And it appears like every day there's another story, another wrinkle, and the University of Missouri just can't get a fair shake. You know, just every day there's more bad news coming out of there. This past week on Wednesday night, the Joint Committee of Education had a hearing, and we had interims President Middleton and Chancellor Foley and the president of the Board of Curators spoke to us. I serve on that committee. And so we had about 2 hours to ask them questions and to go over that. Pretty contentious debate, as you can imagine. I think the takeaways from that is the question the legislature wants to know is who's in charge. Is it the students? Is it the faculty? Is it the board of curators? Is it the president? Is it the chancellor? And, you know, interestingly, the face of all of this is now turned to Melissa Click, the professor.
The professor who was involved in the campus protests.
Who was arrested, convicted, who is now on probation. And so then that brings in the whole issue of teacher tenure. Is she going to be kept on? Will she be granted tenure? And so it brings up a whole lot of other issues dealing with education.
But to your point, I mean, Melissa Click has become the face of that controversy on campus. But really, it's not about Melissa Click. There were some underlying issues, racial tensions on campus,
right,
that had clearly not been addressed sufficiently to satisfy a large group of students and faculty and community members. Do you think steps are being taken to address those issues now in a way that is different?
Well, and that's what's interesting is really that should be our focus right now. I mean, to me, when African-American students come to the University of Missouri, we should embrace that and say that this is a good thing, that they are looking at higher education as a path, as a way to the future, way to improve themselves. And so that's a very positive thing. If students, no matter who they are, feel uncomfortable or feel that they are being taken advantage of, that needs to be addressed. That needs to be looked at. I do think there is a position that's going to be created, a diversity officer, I think a vice chancellor. I think that's a step in the right direction. And so as far as I'm concerned, if the students feel that they're being discriminated against, then there's something to that, and that needs to be looked at. Now, on the other hand, does that mean that any allegation that any student concern, they get exactly what they want? Probably not, but they need to be heard, and those concerns need to be addressed.
on a certain level, the place where the legislature has the most contact with the university system is on the Board of Curators. You as a senator would be voting to confirm members of the Board of Curators, which now has some vacancies.
Right.
What are you looking for in those who would fill those seats on the Board of Curators?
Well, there are 9 positions. There are 3 vacancies. And the governor actually appoints the person, but they have to go through Senate confirmation. And so I think you're looking at a person. And of course, on that particular board, it has to be a geographical representation, and nor can there be more than 5 from one particular political party.
But what are you looking for in the kinds of people you'd like to see the governor appoint that you would vote to confirm?
Well, I think you have to look at a person who is strong to make some bold decisions, some bold changes, who can take charge, and one that's not afraid of controversy.
Is racial diversity important to you?
Oh, absolutely. I think that you have to look at racial diversity, especially with the climate that we have right now. I think we need to have a good mix of gender, of age, geographical. And so I think those are all things that we need to look at.
I want to ask you about another piece of legislation you've sponsored this last couple weeks that got a hearing involving texting while driving. Currently, Missouri bans texting by anyone 21 or under, or under the age of 21.
Right.
You'd like to expand that to cover all drivers. Tell us about that and about the hearing it got. Do you think it's going to pass this session?
Well, this is another issue that I'm taking on this year that I don't know if it has a chance of passing, but I think it's very important to talk about. And you're right. If you're over 21, you can text and drive. And really, the really good texters are the young people, you know, what we call novice drivers. And we passed this several years
ago. So we should be banning it among adults and allowing it among young people.
That's
proposing.
Not what I'm saying.
All
but
right.
when we passed this several years ago, and I came back from the legislature back home and talked to people, the biggest observation I heard is, why didn't you ban it for everybody? You know, it shouldn't be done. And so texting and driving is extremely dangerous, extremely dangerous. It's more dangerous than drunk driving. You're 18 times more likely to be in an accident if you're texting and driving.
Wow.
And, you know, if somebody would have told you 15 years ago that people would be typing and driving at the same time, you said, that's crazy. That'll never happen. But it's here. And so my legislation would ban it for all drivers.
What do you think, Pat?
I'll text you my answer after
right.
you finish.
While you're on your way home from the
yeah, in the car. Yeah. I'm over 21. I'd like to kind of go expand on this. I agree. I mean, why wouldn't we ban it for everybody if it's so closely or so clearly bad? But in general, the Republican Party is seen as a party supporting less government and local control. I know the new federal law is going to have some effect on education as we go through. I forget the name of it, the one that replaced No Child Left Behind.
Every Student Succeeds Act, ESSA.
That's going to have some more local control in it. But when I see the question that comes to my mind is, why do we see so many attempts to intervene in municipal laws, in particular this year, the earnings tax in Kansas City? That seems like a tax that the people support, the people vote on. We're going to vote again in April, I think, on that. Why do the legislature, or why does the legislature, some legislators, and I don't know your position on this, support the idea of banning the local government from imposing a tax that's voted on by the people in that jurisdiction? I don't understand the philosophical underpinnings of that.
Well, I agree it should be a local decision. And I don't think the state has any business to dictate, and it should be up to the voters of Kansas City.
So you'll vote against that?
I will vote against that.
And do you think that has a chance to pass?
You know, I really don't know. It hasn't been on the Senate floor yet. There was, I think, an initiative petition several years ago to mm-hmm. put on the ballot, and it overwhelmingly was defeated in Kansas City. Is that right? Or in St. Louis, the earnings tax?
The Kansas City has repeatedly affirmed
yes.
an earnings
right,
tax.
Right, right. Yeah. Defeating mean that they,
right.
they
defeating
voted
the,
to have it,
right.
keep the local control.
Right. Correct.
Yeah, it passed in St. Louis by a wide margin as well.
Right.
Yeah.
It's a local decision. You know, we have enough to say grace over in Jefferson City. Sometimes we don't do a good enough job on that, and so why expand our authority elsewhere?
Continuing around the table, Jason Rosenbaum, before you ask your next question, I feel like we need to pause and ask you a question, Jason.
Uh-oh. Oh, I'm wondering what this one is.
Jason Rosenbaum was recognized on the floor of the Senate this week because earlier that day, or perhaps even at that moment, he was—well, why don't you tell us what happened, Jason?
Well, it all starts when I got to the Capitol and was picking up a key from Mike Lear of MissouriNet for the fifth floor office of St. Louis Public Radio. And after I had retrieved the key, I went to one of the Capitol elevators. And the elevator was open, but I saw one of Governor Jay Nixon's security detail, or one of his security people, leaving the door open. The governor appeared out of the Capitol basement. We were on the elevator. We have a nice conversation. And this is one of the elevators where there's a side door that opens where the governor's office is on the side on the second floor. And he gets off. He jokingly says, I promise I'll make outrageous news while you're here in Jefferson City, which, by the way, he didn't, thankfully. Mm-hmm. And got off along with two or three other people. His door shuts, and I notice the elevator is not moving. I start pressing several buttons, including the button to open the elevator door, and nothing happens. And I realize that for the first time in my on-again, off-again tenure as a state government reporter in Missouri, I have become stuck in a Missouri Capitol elevator. And I decided whether it was just to kind of calm my nerves or because I'm a huge egomaniac and I want people to put all their attention on me. I think it's probably a little bit of both.
Right, we'll be the judge.
I started live tweeting the experience and actually doing vines about what I was doing in the elevator. And I eventually got out, but by the time I got out, a lot of people knew about it because I had brought the attention upon myself, obviously. That's now, my own fault.
Who actually coined the hashtag Free Jason?
Oh, that was House Speaker Todd Richardson, which was, you know, a big honor that one of the most powerful legislators coined that. And I got to just say, after I got out of the elevator, many people of both parties and of all political persuasions expressed their gladness that I was no longer stuck in the elevator, including Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder, State Senator Jill Shoup of Creve Coeur, Shamed Dogan of Baldwin. And I'm very appreciative of that. I never like to become the story, so to speak. But again, I brought the attention upon myself. If I had never said anything, nobody would have known.
Right.
But I did. There was like a real reason I was tweeting that out. I did want other people to know that this particular elevator was broken,
right,
and that
it's a menace.
Clear,
it's a menace. Honestly, yeah. The state government is under threat. That Capitol elevator needs to be fixed.
And I want to dispel this because I don't want any like undertones here because people have joked about this. I do not feel the governor purposely trapped me in that elevator.
But you have to admit, it is suspicious, Jason.
It is suspicious, but in I've heard that this elevator has broken down before, and I let one of his security people know that what was going on so he didn't step in the elevator. As humorous on paper as it would sound for a governor to be stuck in a Capitol elevator, he is the leader of state government in Missouri, and I would not want that to occur to anybody, let alone him. So I was glad to relay that information to his office, and I want to just express my public appreciation for him being so kind going up there, but also dispel any notions that he was behind this entire fiasco.
All right. We will put that rumor to rest. Thank you for that full disclosure of that not at all embarrassing story of being caught in a Capitol elevator, Jason. David Pierce, do you have any experiences in Capitol elevators that you'd like to share?
Nothing compared to that.
No.
So,
all right.
I think we might have most of the reporters use that elevator.
Right.
That's
I think that's
a great idea.
It's going to be designated the public radio reporters elevator. You had your own exciting moment, though, at the Capitol this week. The Royals World Champion Trophy made its way to the Senate floor, and you were the presiding officer at that moment.
Yeah, that was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Senator Ryan Silvey and Senator Will Krause arranged to have the Royals Trophy come to the Senate chambers. And I just, by luck, was presiding, and we take turns presiding over the Senate, and all of a sudden the doors flew open, and the trophy it's almost like it floated in. The man with the white gloves was holding it.
Is it like at the State of the Union when the doorman says, the President of the United States,
it was almost like the World Championship
trophy?
Well, there was debate going on, and like as soon as the trophy walked in, it was just like there was a hush all over the Senate chamber, and no one was paying attention to the two people that were debating. And then very soon, Senator Sylvia Krause made some announcements, and so I got to introduce, ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome the world champion, Kansas City Royals. So I've been waiting a long time to say that.
It's a pretty good announcer.
It was fun. It was, and I guess he goes by the name of Casey, the man who holds up the big W.
Right.
He was there, and so I had him hold up the W, and yeah, it was really, really fun. Another really fun part is you could really see the who were the Cardinals fans and who were the and who were the Royals fans. And
by the ones crouching beneath their desks at that moment.
That's right. Yeah. So it was a nice rivalry, and we have two great, great baseball franchises in Missouri. So that's a neat thing.
Excellent. Let's go around the table just one more time, starting out in St. Louis with Jason Rosenbaum.
Any question that I want in the entire world that has to do with the Royals, I guess. I'm trying to think of it. Well, kind of going back to Mizzou for a minute, because I was in that hearing as well. And I think that there were a multitude of issues that have cropped up. It's not only Melissa Click, but I think it's just how the protests were handled, kind of how there was this rivalry between Tim Wolf and Bowen Lofton that I think hurt the handling of that.
Yes.
I'm curious for the senator, since you were there and realizing that these are interim people that will probably change, do you feel like the leadership has stabilized since it was pretty apparent that the previous leaders were not really on the same page when the university was dealing with some controversial issues? And if it has, how do you think that's going to affect this debate over whether funding gets cut for the UM system?
It's stabilized somewhat, and I do think that Interim President Middleton and Interim Chancellor Foley get along. I think that's good. And what was interesting about the Bowen Lofton Tim Wolf thing is after the fact, the university kind of put out this thought, well, you should have known all along they didn't get along. You know, like everyone knew that. Well, that was a pretty closely guarded secret until after Wolf resigned and Lofton was assigned somewhere else. So I think it's certainly in a much better situation. But if you recall, Jason, there was one interchange with Representative Courtney Curtis and then also yes. Representative Mike Lehr. Courtney Curtis thought that all the students' demands should be met. What's happening with the student demand? Why aren't they being met? And then President Middleton tried to say, well, we're going to do that. And then almost immediately afterwards, Representative Mike Lehr says, why do you mean? Why do we need to cave in to student demands? And so that's a microcosm right there of what's going on. Should we do what the students say or should we not? Who is in charge? And so I think that is the huge question right now. And quite honestly, when I'm going out in rural Missouri, and it's just not a Columbia issue. I mean, there's people all over that are saying, who is in charge of the University of Missouri system?
And just to piggyback on that moment, I think Representative Curtis and I were at the University of Missouri kind of around the same time, not exactly. And he was referencing the fact that there were kind of racial incidents back then
right.
to bring up the point that not much has changed and they haven't really implemented policies that would have occurred then as well. But I think I asked you this a while ago, and it's something I've been thinking about. Even if that's true, I'm not really sure what the legislature can do about that. They kind of have to leave the trust in the administrators to be able to handle that situation and to create an environment where African-American students don't feel like they're uncomfortable at best or, you know, being racially discriminated at worst. Is that kind of your feeling as well?
Oh, I agree. And you know, we should embrace African-American students at the university. That's wonderful that they are making that decision. And so we need to accommodate that. The budget is about the one place where we can make some decisions mm-hmm. that affect any university. And the House Education Budget Committee has decided to only increase the four-year institutions 2% except for MU, and they're going to freeze their budget. So that's kind of the first volley. I've heard from parents back home that are going to send students to MU, and they say, why are you hurting me? You're not hurting the university. You're not hurting administrators. You're hurting me. It's a tax increase because you're not supporting the institution.
One more question from you, Pat Kelly.
Real quickly, I just saw this in the paper this morning. Senator Schmidt, I believe, has introduced an idea to double the rate or double the amount of tax cuts. And given the rather interesting experiences to the West and Southwest on these massive tax cuts. Is that something you think the state should be looking at to double that 100? I think it was $154 million, try and double that. Is that a good idea?
Well, I think we just need to look to the West. And
you're referring to Kansas, I believe.
And Oklahoma.
Right. And that experiment's not working too well. So I really haven't looked at the details on that. It hasn't come to the Senate floor. I would be very skeptical of that right now.
Thank you. And could I also say thank you so much for having me? This was a wonderful experience.
Well, actually, I'm going to say thank you so much for being here. That's Pat Kelly. He's a Kansas City Public School teacher and a member of the Kansas City Federation of Teachers. Thanks so much for being here.
Again, thank you.
And also Jason Rosenbaum, who's a reporter at St. Louis Public Radio, and always good to have you with us by Skype. Jason, thanks.
Thank you.
Now, Senator David Pierce from Warrensburg, thank you very much for being here.
My pleasure.
We always end our show by asking you to help us end it and pick the music that we're going to go out on. It can be your favorite song. It can be a song that's on your mind. It can be something that you think captures this moment in Missouri politics.
Wow. David Bowie just died a few weeks ago. How about what's the space song?
Space Oddity.
How would that be?
Yes, we can definitely
do
that.
From one David to another.
It's amazing how many legislators do want to pay tribute to David Bowie. That is
really?
It's good to hear.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's fun.
Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can find us on iTunes or on kcur.org/statehouseblend. If you do use Twitter, Senator Pierce does not use Twitter, but
if you do,
it's a good way to keep up on the show and also on the news from Jeff City and Topeka. I'm at PTS Brian. My co-host Sam Zeff is at Sam Zeff. We use the hashtag Statehouse Blend. You can find a shorter version of this podcast on the air on Tuesday mornings as part of Up to Date at 11 a.m. on KCUR. If you have any other thoughts or want to be on the show and sit in that citizen seat that Pat's in today, shoot me an email on brian@kcur.org. I'm Brian Ellison. We'll see you next time.